Support for the California Report comes from the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org. URS, a global engineering and construction firm providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. On today's show, as the election nears, we're looking through the blizzard of campaign ads to make sense of the November ballot. Also, Governor Brown's historic criminal justice realignment puts counties in charge of low-level criminals. 3 years later, how's it going?
I've been involved in law enforcement for 32 years. We have never had a readjustment or realignment or reorganization, however you want to phrase it, as big as this.
Plus, a congressional race in San Diego pits a gay Republican against a vulnerable Democrat, and how to get younger voters to cast ballots.
The first event I went to, and I was like, this is awesome. Like, I have to continue this. So from that point on, I knew that I wanted to be involved in politics somehow because I felt like I could actually make a difference.
It's the California Report. Election Day is less than 2 weeks away, and so we begin today with a look at what's at stake on the November ballot.
I'm not all right with the way things are going, and I think some changes really need to be made, and the only way to make a change is to step up and speak up.
I want to say so in what goes on here. Otherwise, I can't have no reason to complain, and I like to complain a lot.
As an American, it's an awesome right to be able to vote, and I think that everybody should vote.
To help us unravel, decipher, and sort through the election year clutter, we turn to our team of reporters covering the election. And we'll start in the state capitol with Sacramento Bureau Chief Scott Detrow and John Meyer, Senior Editor for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. John, let me start with you. There's a poll out this week from the Public Policy Institute of California. It shows, among other things, that 40% of voters, 40% say they're enthusiastic about casting their ballots. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's going to mean low turnout, Scott. I mean, plain and simple, on Election Day. You know, June was the worst turnout in state history. I think this time it is more significant, given that there are more statewide ballot measures and more local races and local measures. I think it's also a bad omen for Democrats in California, because some of the modeling that's being used by political watchers shows that Republicans are going to be overrepresented in the electorate on November 4th. I think that could be a big factor in some of the down-ticket races.
Yeah, and Scott Detrow, you're following the race for governor. And you got to say, this is one of the weirdest campaigns for governor in that the governor isn't really campaigning.
Yeah, Governor Brown is so confident that he's left the state this weekend to attend his law school reunion at Yale. You're right, Scott. Governor Brown has hardly spent any money on his reelection campaign, and the only ads he's running are about Proposition 1 and 2.
Save water. Save money. Vote yes on 1 and 2.
The thinking seems to be that his opponent, Republican Neil Kashkari, has no money, no real way to get his message out, so that by engaging in a campaign, the only thing Governor Brown would be doing would be elevating Kashkari and generating more attention for his challenger.
Kashkari's had trouble getting traction against the governor. He did that kind of stunt in Fresno where he posed as a homeless person for a while. Has he settled, Scott, on a line of attack against the governor?
He has. The last couple of weeks, Kashkari has only really talked about one issue, and that's Governor Brown's decision to appeal a lower court ruling that says that California's teacher tenure laws basically violate the Constitution.
Shockingly, Jerry Brown turned his back on and betrayed the neediest kids of California, and he's fighting those kids in court today.
I think it is a politically viable issue, but it's kind of too little too late in terms of the campaign itself. It's hard to make a dent at this point, given the financial numbers for Kashkari and the poll numbers, which show him trailing the governor by 16 points at this point in time.
And as Scott said, he isn't running ads for himself, but he is on TV a lot promoting Prop 1. That's the water bond. And here to talk about that, we'll bring in KQED's Dan Brecke. Dan, course, we're in the middle of this historic, terrible drought. That helps the governor get attention on this issue. The Public Policy Institute of California poll this week shows it leading 56-32. So how would that $7.5 billion bond be spent?
Well, there are a wide variety of issues here that there is a great deal of public consensus on. We're talking about things like cleaning up polluted groundwater, conservation projects, water recycling, improved regional water planning, securing safe drinking water, especially for disadvantaged communities, poor communities in places like the San Joaquin Valley that suffer from agricultural pollution. There have been six bond measures passed in the last 20 years to fund projects like this. There's something that's a little bit different here, though. $2.7 billion for water storage. And to the extent that there's any controversy here, that's where it lies.
And the critics are saying that because of that water storage, the dams, reservoirs, however they decide to do it, that this bond is kind of skewed toward agriculture. What's the response to that?
The mainstream water groups, like the Association of California Water Agencies, says, listen, this helps us achieve protection for the environment, and it secures our future water supply. Nobody wants to say that this is all for dams at this point, because there's where the debate comes in is whether that's an efficient way of spending money. And the environmental groups here say, listen, if you really read the bond, water storage doesn't mean dams. So dams may not be cost effective, but future technologies that would help us store water underground could be paid for under this bond.
And so that all needs to get worked out in the future. And that ad with the governor is for Prop 1 and Prop 2, and that one would create a rainy day fund, if ever we get a rainy day around here, for lean budget years. And John Myers, tell us how that would work.
Well, Scott, I think it's really what it is. It's a supercharged version of the rainy day reserve fund that the state already has. It's a bigger one. It would put more money aside every year out of taxpayer dollars based on capital gains, the most volatile part of the tax system in California. And it would repay debts that have already been paid for out of the state over the next several years. It's not controversial in terms of Sacramento, at least once the deal got done. It's just out there, and it's not being talked about a lot except for those ads.
And the poll this week showed Prop 2 kind of struggling a bit. It's ahead, but only 49-34, 17% undecided on Prop 2. And, you know, the governor's out in front on both of those, John, but Prop 1 doing quite a bit better. How do you explain that?
The most interesting part, Scott, to me, is that when you look at that poll, some of the weakest support is among conservative voters. And I think the theory that's out there right now is that you don't see Republicans, you don't even see independents out there campaigning for this budget reserve. You only see the governor. If you're the Democratic governor, maybe you're not the best salesman to conservatives in California for this fund, which they must love, right? I mean, it's talk about saving money, not spending money. But it's in a pretty precarious position this close to the election. So it'll be interesting to watch.
All right. Well, there are two other ballot measures that touch on health issues. Prop 45 would give the state insurance commissioner authority to reject health insurance rate increases if he or she thinks they're too high. Support for that is well below 50%, according to that PPIC poll. And then there's Prop 46, which is a bit more complicated. And if you've watched any TV lately, you've probably been hearing ads like these.
Insurance companies are spending millions of dollars trying to mislead you about the effects of Proposition 46. Well, here's the truth. 46 will save lives.
If Proposition 46 passes, patients like mine will lose access to care.
Police, airline pilots, bus drivers, they're randomly tested for drugs and alcohol, but not us doctors.
Well, here to help us sort out Prop 46 is the California Report's health reporter, April Demboski. And April, this measure, as I said, it's complicated. It calls for several things, including mandatory drug testing of doctors with consequences for those who test positive. It also increases the limit on pain and suffering damages in medical negligence lawsuits from the current $250,000 to just over $1 million. So, you know, who would be affected by that last part, especially raising the cap on damages if Prop 46 passes?
The proposition is really intended to benefit victims of medical malpractice, particularly children, the elderly, people who don't work and can't claim any kind of lost wages. So the proponents say that increasing the cap will increase their ability to find a lawyer who will take their case. And so Lawyers will benefit as well, but not quite to the degree that the campaigns will have you believe.
In terms of who's spending yes and no on 46, though, it is a battle between lawyers who do support it and doctors and insurance companies. They really oppose it. They're spending quite a bit of money to defeat it.
They are. In fact, the medical malpractice insurers are outspending the lawyers 10-1. On ads to try to defeat the measure. And that's because they're the ones who are really going to be footing most of the costs that result from any kind of increase in lawsuits that get filed.
All right. So you got to read the fine print on that one. Two other ballot measures I want to talk about. First, Prop 48. And a yes vote there would ratify tribal gaming compacts between the state and two Indian tribes. John Myers, I know you recently visited Madera County where a casino would be built if Prop 48 passes. What's at stake here?
Well, it's a referendum, which means in California that voters are being asked to rubber stamp the legislature's approval of this tribal casino project or stop it. It's technically an off-reservation casino, would be the first one in California. This was not Indian land until just 3 years ago. I think that is why it has really created this firestorm that voters are going to have to take a look at on Election Day.
And finally, John, Prop 47 has to do with criminal sentences. It would require more minor offenses like drug possession to be treated as misdemeanors rather than felonies. What's the thinking behind that one?
You know, Scott, I think the bottom line here that the backers of 47 say we should be spending limited taxpayer dollars elsewhere. We're spending it on lower level crimes, sending these people behind bars. We shouldn't do it. Prop 47 would redirect some of that money to education and drug treatment programs. Critics say these folks are, in fact, dangerous in a lot of cases. You know, I really think there is nothing simple when it comes to crime and punishment campaigns in California.
And somewhat surprising that there's really no organized campaign against Prop 47. Now, there's a lot of law enforcement groups who are opposed to it, but there's no TV or radio ads opposing it.
It's a quiet campaign. I think you're right. And I also think that the intensity of crime and punishment in the state has changed a little bit over the last several years with prison overcrowding being in the news. You remember three strikes was amended recently to kind of modify those crimes as well. People think Californians may be ready to reconsider the punishment for some of these crimes.
All right. Well, lots to think about. Thanks to all of you, John Myers and Scott Detrow in Sacramento, Dan Brecke and April Demboski with me here in the studio. Thanks again.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Scott.
Thank you.
Well, as John Myers alluded to, the state's approach to criminal justice has gone in a very new direction under Jerry Brown, driven in part by a court order to improve inmate health care and reduce the state's prison population. The problem dates back to 1990 in a lawsuit over the quality of mental health care for inmates. Underlying it all, too many prisoners and too few cells. The federal courts were ordering the state to reduce its inmate population. Here's Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in 2006 telling the state legislature that the prisons were powder kegs.
Our prisons are in crisis. We have inherited a problem that was put off year after year after year.
Finally, 5 years later, the legislature passed AB 109. It was the most fundamental reform of California's criminal justice system in more than a generation. It was called realignment, and it transferred responsibility for tens of thousands of low-level criminals from state prisons to county jails and probation officers. UC Berkeley criminologist Barry Crisberg says California adopted realignment so fast, counties struggled just to keep their heads above water.
I mean, if you had done this logically, you would have announced everyone we're going to do it. You probably would have spent a year or so planning it out, training, and making it happen. That's not how realignment happened. It just happened.
That process, or lack thereof, rankles critics of realignment, including Michael Rushford of the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation in Sacramento.
It was a 425-page bill. It never saw a committee hearing. It was never brought to the floor, passed both houses and went to the governor's desk without debate, kind of in the back room somewhere.
Realignment took effect 5 months after the governor signed it into law, leaving local law enforcement officials scrambling. The biggest immediate impact was felt in county jails. We visited a Fresno County jail in the summer of 2012. We met inmates there who had served time in state prisons. They said conditions in the jail were much worse than state prison.
There's no programs here. There's no school. There's no education. There's no jobs. I mean, we go to the yard. This yard is once a week, every Monday for an hour. That's it. No sunlight, no fresh air.
Several said they'd rather go back to state prison. Conditions in jail were that bad. At the time, Sheriff Margaret Mims called realignment a triple whammy.
We were hit so hard, so fast, with many more inmates, and we're all scrambling to figure out how we're going to deal with it.
In the first 2 years of realignment, the state sent $2 billion to counties. Each could use the money to implement the new policy however it saw fit. The overarching goal was to reduce the churn of parole violators in and out of state prisons, and to let counties manage low-level offenders. From Governor Jerry Brown's perspective, realignment was a huge success, and he said so early last year.
There's no question that there were big problems in California prisons. Overcrowding, health care, lack of mental health care. But after decades of work, the job is now complete.
But for counties, the job was just beginning. Fresno Sheriff Margaret Mims, sitting in her office this week, reflecting back on the first 3 years of realignment.
I've been involved in law enforcement for 32 years. We have never had a readjustment or realignment or reorganization, however you want to phrase it, as big as this.
Mims is happy about one thing. Fresno is using $80 million from the state to build a brand new jail. They'll need it. County jails were designed to house inmates for relatively short periods of time. Now, one prisoner in Fresno is serving an 18-year sentence. UC Berkeley's Barry Crisberg.
So suddenly you had people who were getting very long sentences under existing sentencing laws, but now to county jails. And county jails are designed to hold people for a year, not for 5 years.
With those longer sentences come higher health care costs for inmates, a burden shifted from the state to local government. Liberal counties like San Francisco quickly embraced realignment. Resistance was strongest inland, in places like Kings County, where Sheriff Dave Robinson was an outspoken critic. And now?
I'm still a lock them up and throw away the key kind of guy for certain things, like the sex offenses, gang offenses, etc. But on some of these realigned crimes, I do think we have some opportunities to make a difference in people's lives and turn them around so they don't become, you know, career criminals.
3 years into it, realignment has not solved the state's prison overcrowding problems, as Governor Brown promised it would. The inmate population dropped about 25,000, but there's still nearly 3,000 inmates too many to satisfy the courts. On the other hand, the shift hasn't led to the rising crime rates that critics feared. Property crimes did go up at first, but are back down again, and violent crime is still at historically low levels. But that's little consolation to Michael Rushford with the Conservative Criminal Justice Legal Foundation.
It's going to be when every neighborhood has a dead body, then all of a sudden it's going to become an issue. So it's okay to say everything's fine. We can just let that happen. I know what's going to happen.
So far, it seems that local officials have largely adapted to realignment, and early critics, like Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims, say the funding formula has been tweaked, so rural counties like hers get more state money. Still, she worries the money will eventually go away.
My fear is, and what has happened historically, is 5 or 10 years down the road, people forget this was a state issue, not a county issue. And then we'll say, okay, county, this is your deal. Why are we paying for it?
Realignment isn't an issue in this year's campaign for governor, and it could take years to see if Jerry Brown's signature criminal justice law succeeds or fails. The race for San Diego's 52nd congressional district is attracting national attention and lots of money. That's because it's one of the few House races that seems like a real toss-up. KPBS reporter Claire Tregesser tells us about the two men battling it out for the seat.
Congressman Scott Peters is worth over $40 million, one of the richest in Congress. But Peters wanted more, voting himself two huge pay raises.
Another politician who owes the Tea Party everything. Carl DeMaio's exactly what's wrong with Washington.
San Diego's 52nd congressional race quickly turned nasty with TV ads like these. Because the race is so tight, it's attracted more than $3.5 million in outside spending from groups like Planned Parenthood and the Koch brothers-funded Americans for Prosperity. One of the most commonly used attacks in the race is for both Republican former city councilman Carl DeMaio and Democratic incumbent Scott Peters to paint themselves as moderate and each other as extreme. Here's Peters.
What I've laid out is a very stark difference between me and a record of being a problem solver, being rewarded by my colleagues with leadership positions because they trust me, and Mr. DeMaio, who's been really the local version of the Tea Party, someone who's been on the outside throwing rocks in.
DeMaio wouldn't be interviewed for this story, but he defended himself against the Tea Party label during a recent NBC San Diego debate.
Wait, Scott. Let's just stop right here. You want to continue to apply labels to me because you can't defend your own record. So you can call me names all you want. All right, I haven't sat there and called you names. I have issues that I disagree with you on. But to sit there and say, I'm just going to call my opponent a Tea Party right-wing nutjob extremist, Scott, it's dishonest, it's divisive, and it's what's wrong with politics today.
A poll out this week shows the two candidates in a statistical tie. Peters narrowly won the seat in 2012, becoming one of 16 Democrats who stole seats from incumbent Republicans. The district's voter registration is almost evenly divided among Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. That means the freshman Democrat seat is and likely always will be vulnerable, so Democrats are spending time and money to establish ownership of the seat. President Barack Obama fundraised for Peters in May, while House Speaker John Boehner fundraised for DeMaio this month. Both candidates claim very similar stances on many issues. DeMaio, who is openly gay, supports same-sex marriage, environmental protections, and a woman's right to an abortion. But Peters says DeMaio's moderate stances are new. Peters points out he's been endorsed by Planned Parenthood, while DeMaio has, until recently, been relatively silent on women's issues.
He held his first press conference on women's issues, didn't even have anything on his website, and came out supporting Lilly Ledbetter Act, which has already been on the books for 5 years, so it's about time. Supported the Republican birth control idea, which provides birth control over the counter, but doesn't provide a guarantee that it will be paid for.
DeMaio repeatedly attacks Peters for taking government perks while serving in Congress and on the San Diego City Council.
Privileged Peters, a millionaire, elected to take a taxpayer-funded car allowance to pay for his luxury BMW. This is the same privileged Peters that lives in this luxury home and double-dipped on the taxpayers by taking his pension early.
The whole thing's ridiculous because the whole discussion doesn't create a job, doesn't educate a kid, doesn't provide for anyone's retirement.
Peters says he took the same car allowance as every other council member. He donates his city pension to libraries, and he returned $140,000 of his city council salary. Peters says his biggest achievement so far in Congress is helping San Diego's delegation work well together. DeMaio told KPBS's television news program in June that if elected, he hopes to focus on a fiscal agenda.
The national debt, getting jobs created, making sure that we provide quality services, particularly for our veterans.
This month, a former campaign worker alleged DeMaio sexually harassed him. DeMaio vehemently denies the claims. The incident has not been resolved, but it's brought even more national attention to the race. For the California Report, I'm Claire Tregesser in San Diego.
It wouldn't be a stretch to say that no one has more at stake in this election, or any election really, than voters under the age of 25. After all, they and their kids are the ones who will be around long enough to deal with the long-term impacts of decisions made now on things like the environment, healthcare, and the economy. And yet younger Americans are typically the least likely to vote. Reporter Sam Harnett visited a class at San Francisco State University where students are getting hooked on the power of local politics.
Ashley Gibson is out campaigning for one of San Francisco's local ballot initiatives.
This is the Proposition G campaign, and this is to end the Ellis Act evictions. So it would create a tax on speculation, which is investors coming in and flipping homes. So create a tax on.
Like many young people, Gibson first got excited about politics because of a national election. It was 2008. She was 19 and decided to volunteer for the Obama campaign.
Yeah, the first event I went to, and I was like, this is awesome. Like, I have to continue this. So from that point on, I knew that I wanted to be involved in politics somehow because I felt like I could actually make a difference.
But over the last 6 years, she's become a bit disappointed with national politics, the gridlock, and lack of change.
in part, I was a little bit naive. I think I also was just very, very enthusiastic and optimistic about things and probably a little bit unrealistic.
Gibson has since grown up a bit, but she hasn't given up. She's become a political science major at San Francisco State University. And now she's more engaged with local campaigns, where she feels like she can make a bigger impact. That led her to Calvin Welch's course on San Francisco politics and history.
Kids are really hungry for history of redevelopment, of urban renewal. They've heard about it, or maybe a relative was involved, but no one's ever explained it.
Welch says many students are like Gibson, excited by Obama, let down by national politics, and now interested in local issues, which he says young people really get into. That is, once they learn about them.
It grabs their interest because they see the end result of it without me explaining it. I mean, they live it. It is very real.
Welch's course is the only one at San Francisco State that focuses on the city's politics. He says there used to be two others, but they've since been cut. Now professors mostly concentrate on national, international, and theoretical issues. Terry Givens says this is typical of poli-sci departments across the country.
There really isn't necessarily an incentive to focus on local politics, particularly if you have ambition to move up in the field or to move to another university, which might be more prestigious.
Givens is a professor of political science who writes on the discipline for Inside Higher Ed. Theory, she says, is considered rigorous. Professors focus on it to publish papers and get jobs. But for students like Ben Gershon, it's local history and policy that help him understand how theory works in the real world.
Theory is very abstract. It's very up in the air.
Gershon is a poli-sci major and a student in Welch's class. He doesn't imagine himself becoming a political scientist or a politician. He's actually an aspiring musician who wants to entice young people to politics with art.
So I'm trying to find this balance of politics and art and trying to get people engaged through art and still working out the ideas, but that's where my head's at right now.
Gershon says Welch's course has taught him how effective community engagement can be.
When you don't know your history, you can't imagine a future that's different from the present.
Now, it's one thing to participate in politics to pass a course, but what about after they graduate? Do any of the students still care? Well, some do.
My name is Jane Kim. I am a member of the Board of Supervisors representing District 6, which includes the Tenderloin, South of Market, Mission Bay, and Treasure Island.
Jane Kim is one of two current city supervisors and four aides who took Welch's class. Back then, Kim was in her early 20s and didn't know she'd go into elected politics. She just wanted to learn local history, something she didn't get studying political science at Stanford. Calvin's course was an eye-opener.
Calvin was the first one to really explain how land use worked and the balance of land use to me. And I still remember that breakthrough moment. And, you know, that still stays with me today in the policy work that I do.
Now, Professor Welch doesn't expect all of his students to go on to careers in city halls. But he does expect them to know about the ballot initiatives this year in San Francisco. They are part of the class's final project. For the California Report, I'm Sam Harnett.
For all of our election coverage, including a voter guide to the November ballot, click on over to californiareport.org. And that is The California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman and Dan Bringer. The online team includes David Weir, Lisa Pickoff-White, and David Marks. Our interns are Adiza Egan and Isaac Silk. The California Report's editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Polly Stryker, Julia McAvoy, and Ingrid Becker. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Support for the California Report comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children.